So the first topic of our three-part series is indeed religious tolerance in a Jewish state. And you know, I figured, why not jump right in with the first source? Why wait? Why be coy about it? And that's the current iteration of the ongoing challenge of what to do at the Western Wall. Right? The Western Wall is what? What's the historical significance of the Western Wall? It's the retaining wall for the Temple Mount, right? When they backfilled it to broaden the space on top, this was the retaining wall for it. It is the closest publicly available site where you could have people gather in terms of getting close to the temple. Yes, there are digs underground that get closer to the site of the temple, but those aren't outfitted for mass gatherings. And yes, there actually is the mound on top, but take your pick as to who's going to stop you from going there. But you aren't going to hold a Jewish prayer service on top. And so the result of that is a lot of tension about who is going to control the Western Wall Plaza and what the rules are going to be for prayers to be held there. If you take a look at source number one, this is a JTA article. I picked JTA. I had seen a whole bunch of articles about it, but some were left and some were right. And I said, you know what? Let's just take JTA. They're supposed to just sort of be reporting the news as opposed to picking a side. So this is from January 11th. Israeli Supreme Court ruling favors women's prayer at Western Wall. Israel's Supreme Court has ruled in favor of women being allowed to read from the Torah in the women's section at the Western Wall and declared that an egalitarian prayer area set aside at nearby Robinson's Arch does not constitute access to the holy site, right? That was the previous compromise. The previous compromise was go around. You don't have to be on the western side. You can be on the southern side, and you can have everything you want there and leave the western side for the traditionalists. And the some of the women who were petitioning said, okay, great. And some of them said, that's not enough. We want to be able to do what we want to do, where we want to do it. And they petitioned the court, and the court declared, as you see here, you're right, that's insufficient. Robinson's Arch is not good enough. In an interim injunction announced Wednesday, that will be last Wednesday, and the court gave the wall's Orthodox administrators and state agencies 30 days to show cause why women cannot pray, quote, in accordance with their custom, end quote, or allow them to pray as they choose. We'll see what happens. They have 23 days to go. But that's item number one, a headline case, which is very personal for a lot of people. Both the women who say we want to pray there that way and the men who agree with them. And on the other side, those who say, women and men, we would like to have the Western Wall as our place. This is a place that we yearned for, that we prayed for, that we fought for, that we endangered ourselves to get to for thousands of years, and it was always this way. You can't come along and tell us you want to use this place differently. And that's the strife regarding this plaza. Yes, I haven't even said anything yet, so keep the tomatoes. Yes?
Actually, about a year ago, Sharansky brokered a deal between the ultra-Orthodox,
right,
and the woman, where it was agreed in writing that the woman could have Robinson's Arch.
Right.
And thereafter, the ultra-Orthodox relate, and they have prevented the woman, or they have made it very difficult for these women to pray at the Robinson's Arch, or have done their services there. They have impeded them, they have created all kinds of brackets to try and discourage them from coming. I think that is the gist of it. And that's why the woman then took it to the Supreme Court.
See, I hear what you're saying, but the articles I've seen didn't reflect that. The articles I've seen, like this one from the JTA, reflect the women's group saying, we actually aren't happy with the compromise, having nothing to do with meeting any opposition. But I'll go with what you're saying, because it doesn't change the substance of the matter. The substance of the matter is, when one group says, we would like to practice Judaism in a particular way in this location, and another group says, we don't want you to do so, what do we do? So stipulating either way doesn't change the problem that we want to deal with. Yeah?
Well, Well, in this regard, the wall belongs to all Israelis. It is not a shul. It is a national monument to Judaism. So all Jews should be allowed to go and pray. And if they did this compromise, where they said the Orthodox will pray with their always here, and they gave a specific portion to the woman and egalitarian and sorti and reform and said they can pray there, and that was the firm agreement. And I haven't heard that the woman wanted to renege on that at all.
You see it right here, though, at number one. You see it right here. Right? They petitioned the Supreme Court that they weren't satisfied with that, and the Supreme Court agreed with them that it doesn't constitute access to the holy site. The women were the ones who reneged as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. But the issue is not who reneged. I don't want to get bogged down in who reneged because accusations aren't going to help. Fundamentally, you made a point saying that this is not a shul, this is a national site. Do you think that's the only way to see the circumstance? Because you know that there are an awful lot of people who disagree and say, no, this isn't a national site, this is a shul.
But then you're making it something for a section of the citizenship, when in fact it was liberated for all of Israel, for all Jews.
And that's an argument, but you can easily see an argument the other way, I hope. Well, the challenge that we're going to face is the inability to see both sides. The reality is that while your argument is cogent, in the sense that the army that liberated it in 1967 was an army of the entire Jewish people, it was not made up exclusively of one particular sect. Having said that, the drive to be there for literally thousands of years did come from a particular sect. The spiritual ancestors of these people who are there now are the ones who prayed and fasted on Tisha B'Av. They're the ones who did things a certain way. And their argument, whether I agree with them or not, isn't the point. The point is that there is another side.
But it could be argued that the ancestors of the egalitarian people who want to have the right to pray at the wall also have the same ancestry who, fasted on Tisha B'Av, who observed all the laws. But their personal beliefs, they've evolved into an egalitarian point of view.
Right.
I'm not saying one is right and
correct.
One is wrong.
No.
But that's their...
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize that as well. There are multiple arguments that can be made. And the problem that we run into is, how do you run a country this way? When everybody has multiple arguments they can make. Take a look at the second source, because I want to show just how problematic this is. Originally, when civil rights legislation came to be, and I don't mean in Israel, I mean internationally, civil rights legislation originally was not about what one person did to another person. It was about what nations did, what governments did. And governments are allowed to do X, and governments are not allowed to do Y, based on respecting individual freedoms and based on respecting people's race, color, creed, and so on. However, it became clear over time that that's insufficient. Because you can't allow an individual to say, I don't want to sell my house to somebody of a different color. That's, from the standpoint of our civilization, that's anathema. You can't allow people to discriminate against others and say, well, I'm a private citizen. I'm going to employ whoever I wish to employ. And so what you find is civil rights legislation that is not only about what the government can do, but also about what individual citizens can do. So if you take a look at source number two, this is from an article called Civil Rights and Privatization in Israel by Daphna Barak Erez. Arguing for the application of civil rights to privatized enterprises rests on a growing willingness to disregard the public-private distinction and abandon the traditional view limiting civil rights to citizen-government relationships. As noted, this view has been curtailed, especially in Europe, where some national constitutions have been interpreted as applying directly or indirectly to private relations as well, and she wrote this article years ago. It's only moved more in that direction since, so that all the rules against discrimination are basically applied to individual citizens, their businesses, their homes, their schools, and so forth. with some exception, but it's basically moving in that direction, and I think is going to continue realistically to move in that direction. Which means it's not only going to be a question of the Western Wall Plaza and what you can do there, it's going to be a question inside an Orthodox synagogue of what you can tell people they can do and they cannot do. Are you discriminating against if a man comes into the Orthodox synagogue and says, I'd like to sit in the women's section, are you discriminating against him if you say, actually, here we sit in the men's section? Right? Fundamentally, he should be able to do that which he wishes to do. Now, you'll say, but there has to be a limit somewhere. But it's very hard to draw that line, which is why we have the problems we do. So, what I want to talk about this evening is how we deal with problems like this, and it goes well beyond the Western Wall. It goes to, you know, in the state of Israel, it goes to buses running on Shabbos. It goes to restaurants being able to sell chametz on Pesach. It goes to any number of other issues that go beyond the current headline. So one might ask, why can't we all just get along? Live and let live. You do what you want to do. They do what they want to do. You don't want, you're a Jewish woman who doesn't want to wear tefillin? Okay, so you go and don't wear tefillin. She wants to go and wear tefillin. Let her go and wear tefillin. You don't want to read from the Torah? That's fine. Let her go and read from the Torah. It doesn't hurt you. You're a man. You're on the other side of the wall anyway. It doesn't make a difference. So there are four challenges that are inherent here, three of which come from Jewish sources and one of which is simply practical. The first challenge is a verse found in Parshat Kedoshim. It's in source number 3. It's in the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. If we could just stop there, we'd be great. Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. We can vote for that one, I hope. That one doesn't require a debate. Hocheach tochiach et amitecha. Educate your friend. Lehochiach is often translated as to rebuke, but lehochiach is to demonstrate, to show, to prove. It's an act of education. Educate your friend, velo tisa alavchet, and do not bear sin for him. As the sages explain this line, what they're saying is, if I see somebody doing something wrong, I have a responsibility to explain what's wrong about what they're doing. And if I don't, I am responsible for what they're doing. I bear sin. So what I'm supposed to do is, don't hate him in your heart and say to yourself, I'm better than he is, he's a rotten guy. Don't do that. Tell him what he's doing wrong. And if you don't, you're responsible for his wrongdoing. In other words, be a busybody. That's what it's saying, right? This is the basis for all of us running around telling everybody what they ought to be doing. This is the opposite of mind your own business. This is no. God says, mind other people's business. That's the message. Yes?
Is that in your judgment, if you judge according to your standards,
yeah,
that somebody is not in compliance,
yeah,
with what you feel he should be,
yeah,
you should educate him?
You got it. This is judgmental in the extreme.
Because didn't Rabbi Hillel say that what is hurtful to you, you should not do to others?
Correct.
It may be hurtful to this person to bring to bear on him your personal judgment.
Yep.
Aren't you then in contravention of that mitzvah?
I'll make the problem worse. This is Leviticus chapter 19, sentence 17. Chapter 19, sentence 18, the very next biblical verse says, Lo tikom velo titoret b'nei amecha. Do not take revenge and do not bear a grudge against your fellow citizen. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Ani Hashem. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am God. And that's the verse that Hillel teaches, except that instead of doing it in the positive of to love, he says, don't do that which they hate. He words it in the negative, which is its own discussion of why he does so. He says, man desan ilach l'chavrach lo sabe. That which is hateful to you, don't do to others. So, here I have a problem. One verse says, tell him what he's doing wrong. The next verse says, You should love him, and don't do things to him that are hateful, that which is hateful to you, don't do to others. So what do you think the resolution of that contradiction is?
Well,
it's not pick whichever one you like.
You may be wrong in your judgment.
Correct. So what's the resolution?
Used to a certain subject, and you are judging him on your particular interpretation or your views.
Right. But I don't even have to be wrong, even if I'm right. In other words, even if he and I subscribe to the same religious system, and both of us subscribe to the belief that stealing is bad, if I walk into the supermarket and I see him in the produce section and he's eating grapes out of the bag, according to his system and according to my system, what he's doing is wrong. Do you think he's going to love me when I go over and say to him, you know that's called shoplifting? Right? Do you think he's going to be happy? No. So the question is, so how do you reconcile these two points? So the technical answer, Shirley, you want to say?
I thought it was, if you thought the person was going to listen to you, you keep your view to yourself.
So the basic answer is, as Shirley notes, that the duty to the individual Jew is to find a positive way to say this, a way that is not going to inspire animosity, and to work to find that way in order to fulfill this commandment. It's not just to say the first thing that comes to mind and to say, I see them doing something wrong, I got them now. Right? That's the wrong mentality. But even in the best of worlds, even where I'm the most kind and thoughtful and sensitive individual, bottom line is, what you're telling me is that if I see someone doing something that in my judgment is wrong, I have a responsibility to find a way to intervene. How's that going to work in a society with religious freedom? That's problem number one. Problem number two is source number four. It's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, the teachings of our sages, which are mixed between some teachings which are ethical and some teachings which are about the study of Torah, but the particular one here says, "Ve'al titchaber la'rasha." Do not join with a wicked person. Once again, this is wicked in your assessment. Whatever you judge to be wicked, you're not supposed to join in with somebody who is doing something that you believe is inappropriate. And I brought you in source number five, a public letter, an open letter, written by Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman was a leading rabbi in Poland pre-war. He was murdered by the Nazis. But in 1934, he sent a letter to those observant Jews who wanted to join forces with the Histadrut, with the labor union, Histadrut HaOvdim. And he said the following. I brought you the Hebrew original so that those who have the Hebrew skills would be able to follow along in the original, but I'm going to use the English. It has been proposed that they join with the Histadrut of the Ovdim. That's actually, I have to show you the play on words there. Ovdim with an ayin is the workers. Ovdim with an aleph is those who are lost. Right, those who are lost. So the Histadrut of the Ovdim, he writes it with an aleph, the Histadrut of the lost, the union of the lost. It is known to all that the heads of this organization have set out a goal of uprooting the Torah from its roots with an upraised arm, and to educate and raise a new nation of Israel in place of the old nation of Israel. And it is clear that one may not partner and join with them in any way. Even dwelling in their neighborhoods is prohibited. Woe to the wicked, woe to his neighbor. No cooperation. So not only am I not supposed to let them do what they're doing, but I'm not allowed to join forces with them, even on apparently innocent matters. So that's a second problem. And then a third problem. Source number six. This is a statement that Moses makes to the Jews regarding sin taking place in the land of Israel. And he says, "You shall not cause sin in the land which Hashem your God is giving to you as your portion." In other words, the first two commands are generic. They're not necessarily Israel-specific. But there's a further problem. If I'm in Israel and I think what they're doing is wrong, then I have to worry that they are contaminating the land. So that's a third problem. And then the fourth and last problem, because we need to get to some solutions or I'm going to get depressed. But the fourth problem is practicality, which is, even if you have well-meaning people who want to have everybody work out a solution so that each person and each individual sect can do as they choose, you're going to run into practical problems that that creates. The most obvious being marriage. Because if people can marry whomever they want, however they want, then what you will end up having happen is what frankly already happens in many communities, which is guy and girl meet however they meet, arranged dating, whatever it is, and they'd like to get married, and one side says to the other, can you bring me the ketubah of the great-grandparents in order to prove that everybody is on the up and up, that they were, if they were converted, they were converted properly, I need to see papers, if they were married, they were married properly, if they were divorced and remarried, that everything was done properly, and so on and so on and so on. If you're going to create a system in which anybody can do anything, then it's going to become very hard for people to trust. And what you will end up with is people who are concerned about such things marrying within their own little family. You will have all sorts of genetic problems as a result of that. It can create big problems. You also run into problems because state actions will sometimes make personal observance impossible. You heard about the Muslim girls in Switzerland? You heard about this story. This is a horrific story from my perspective. I can't understand why this is happening, but apparently it is. Take a look at number 7, please. An article from the British paper The Independent. Also, last week, Muslim girls must swim with boys in Switzerland. This is talking about a couple who have two daughters who go to I forget which school it is that they go to. And the school has said, we have swimming lessons. Growing up in Switzerland, it's required that students take swimming. And the swimming lessons are co-ed. And the parents said, we don't want our girls going co-ed swimming. Leave aside your personal opinion about mixed swimming. They didn't want it for their daughters. And the government told them, you must send your daughters to go mixed swimming. And in the event that you don't, we will fine you. And the parents ate the fine rather than send their daughters, but they took the case to the European Court of Human Rights. The couple then lodged their case with the ECHR, source number 7, alleging that the requirement to send their daughters to mixed swimming lessons violated Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights. The ECHR unanimously threw out their complaint, finding there had been no violation of freedom of religion, and that Switzerland's right to facilitate, quote, successful social integration according to local customs and mores, took precedence over parents' wish to refuse. Oh, boy. You think so?
Yes.
Why is that fair?
They could send the girls to an all-girls school.
So it's fair for me to say that that everybody can pray as they choose at the Western Wall Plaza, but it's not fair for me to say that parents have the right to choose whether their children are going mixed swimming or not.
No, I don't think that's a fair comparison. I'll tell you why.
That I'm sure of.
I choose to go to an Orthodox shul.
Yes.
And then as a man, you wouldn't go and sit in the woman's section.
Okay.
But if you wanted to sit with a man and woman together,
yes,
you would go to
conservative. Understood.
And you have total freedom to do and choose whatever you want.
Yes.
So you didn't impose and you didn't detract from their freedom. They chose to send their girls to a mixed school. And in the mixed schools, they have mixed sports. And they have mixed swimming.
Right.
So the choice was the parents, not the state.
But that's not what the state said. The state didn't say this is a function of the school. This is a function of we want successful social integration according to our customs.
That's what the state wants, but then you could have still decided.
If frankly,
you could have decided, nevertheless, we don't like that sort of social integration for our girls at that age. We are sending our girls to a
But they don't have that option. In other words, if you follow the logic of the European Court on Human Rights, what this says is the government has within its rights to say all children have to go mixed swimming no matter what school they're in. If we believe that this is proper integration in our society, then it's going to be true for everybody. You don't have to take the swimming case. The swimming case happened to be in the news last week. You could take the burqa issues. right? The question of whether they're allowed to wear the hair coverings or the body coverings when they go to the beach. Right? All of these things. You end up with a system in which it becomes very difficult for people to live as they choose. Now, you could say, well, they don't have to go to Switzerland. Let them live somewhere else. That's a horrific thing to say to people. If you don't like our system, get out of our country. It's not
before
civilized. The requirements change over time. I don't think that mixed swimming was a requirement in Switzerland, you know, 50 years ago. That's true. You do have to teach your children to swim within Judaism. This is correct. But the point that I'm trying to make is that we have four challenges, three of which are religious and one of which is practical. The religious is Jewish law, as stated biblically, telling me that I'm supposed to educate others, not to join with a wicked person, and that I have to protect the land of Israel from sin, and then a practical issue of how can I live as an observant Jew in a society which is going to cater to everybody and thereby potentially make it practically difficult. So we're not going to stop here. We're not giving up. But it's important to understand the obstacles that we're facing. I believe that there are four potential philosophical approaches which have been charted over the last decades towards creating a religious community that enables freedom. The first approach, quite frankly, abdicates responsibility. Says, you know what? I, as an observant Jew, am an individual. If you take the aggregate of my community, we make up a certain percentage of the population. We are not the majority. We're certainly not the entire community. We can't legislate for everybody. It's simply not possible. It's not feasible practically. So we'll wait till Mashiach comes, and Mashiach will take care of it. And until then, we're going to do what we want to do in our shul, in our community, and they'll do what they want to do. And that's the way that we'll survive. Jews have done this for a very long time outside of Israel. Meaning that's what we did as a minority in any number of countries. You didn't see Jews trying to change government law, right, in North America, certainly, but also in Europe and so on, to make it fit Jewish law. It didn't make any sense, right? It's been very interesting the last several decades because the Catholics have tried to drag the Jews into doing this. In the United States, when the Catholics weigh in on issues like prayer in the public schools or abortion legislation, they try to drag in observant Jews and to say, we want you to file a brief also, even though the Catholic Church does not necessarily take the same stance that we do, which makes things very awkward and uncomfortable. But the first approach is simply to say, we can't tell everybody what to do. We do what we do. They do what they do. And as for source number three and source number four and all that, it's not within our power to do anything about it. Yes?
You raised an interesting point, and that is in Europe, with the pogroms and all that, where the governments of the times tried to tell Jews how they should behave and that they should convert, and basically persecuted the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And then at last came 48, and the Jews had their own state.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, now we're going to have total religious freedom.
Well, that actually, not necessarily.
We can now live as Jews,
yeah,
in Israel. And then you have the rabbinate saying, no, you haven't got religious freedom in Israel. You must conduct yourself religiously as we dictate.
Actually, religious freedom was not a problem for Jews pre-48. Survival in Europe was a problem. Ethnic survival having nothing to do with being religious or not religious. The Germans did not care about whether you were a Shabbat observer or not. Our issues with religious freedom were not there pre-state. In the 15th century.
Yes,
but that was a long time gone by the time we hit 1948. I mean, the Inquisition lasted for a very long time. It was technically on the books until the 19th century. But even still, no. The State of Israel was not founded to solve a problem of religious freedom. That's just not so. But take a look at source number 8, please.
Source
Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, the second modern chief rabbi in Israel after Rav Kook, took this approach. Now, his essay that I brought you in number 8, the Hebrews on one side, the English goes over to the other side, is not dealing with the problem of Jews and Jews. His essay is talking about the question of Jews and non-Jews, and whether you can have churches in the state of Israel, or whether somehow that means, you know, we have a state now, we're responsible to also to ban other religions. Lots of luck, as he said. If you take a look at what he said, what should we do? Tell the nations we can't accept this condition because our sacred Torah prohibits a Jewish government from allowing Christians and certainly pagans to dwell in our land. And further, it prohibits us from allowing their worship in our land, and it prohibits us from allowing them to acquire land. He says, I can't imagine finding a rabbi in Israel with a brain and straight intellect who would think we should respond with this, meaning that this is the Torah's duty for us. He says, come on, that's nonsense. You can't do that. And by extension, the argument is made, you can't tell other Jews either that this is what they have to do. And that's argument number one. That's approach number one. And it solves some of the problems, right? It solves the problem of educate others. I can't. It's not within my capacity to educate others in this regard. But it's inadequate on other fronts. It doesn't help with the problem of, well, there's sin going on in the land. It doesn't help with the problem of, I am joining with them if I join their organizations, their political parties, and so on. It's an inadequate solution, and maybe we can do better. So the second approach was the approach favored by Rabbi Kook in Orot HaTchiya. I didn't bring you the original Hebrew there because I cut and pasted a translation that was put out, and I didn't want to retype the Hebrew. But Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Kook is well known for this approach. He wasn't the only one to do it, but to see value in the actions of people who don't observe the way that I do. To look at them and say, these are people who still have spiritual value, and because of that, I'm not going to emphasize what they're doing that I think is wrong. I'll look at the parts that they're doing that I think are right, the part that I do value of what they do. Take a look at number 9, please. He speaks of the nefesh and the ruach. Nefesh and ruach are two parts of the soul in Jewish thought. And he says the nefesh, which is the lower part of the soul, as I noted there in Kabbalistic tradition, the nefesh of sinners of Israel in the, quote, footsteps of Messiah, the era that we're in now, those who join lovingly the causes of the Jewish people, Eretz Yisrael, and the national revival, their nefesh, he says, is more corrected, more refined, than the nefesh of the perfect believers of Israel who lack this advantage of the essential feeling for the good of the people and the building of the nation and land. He says their nefesh is greater than the nefesh of those who are more pious, because they have this love of the nation. They have this love of the land. And I see value in them that's greater than those who lack that which they have. But then he says the ruach, which is a higher part of the soul, is much more corrected in the God-fearing and Torah observant, even though the essential feeling and arousal to Jewish activism are not yet firm in them. And in other words, he says, nobody's perfect. Some people are better in this regard, some people are better in that regard, and I'm not going to drum people out because they're imperfect. Now, not everybody was happy with Rabbi Kook's approach, not only from a religious perspective, but even people who were not personally observant, some of them were offended by what he was saying. Who are you to say that, you know, what I'm doing is spiritually important? I'm doing it because I think it's important. I don't care about your spirituality. I don't care about, you know, your system. Not everybody was thrilled with this approach. But his approach was also brought by Rabbi Moshe Avigdor Amiel, if you take a look at source number 10. He says, I do not believe in any way that these are people who do not believe. Talking about pioneers who were secular. He says, I don't think they have no belief. I don't think they're atheists. It is more likely that they are, quote, died in this. I was struggling to translate this. You know what the Hebrew speakers who know, what does it mean when someone is savua? You know the word? Savua. Savuim are hypocrites. Saying one thing but believing another. Died, colored. So he says, it's more likely that they are dyed in this. I didn't want to write hypocritical because that's a harsh word and he didn't mean it that way. Their mouths and hearts are not aligned. Their commitment to the land of Israel borders on the fanatic extreme at times. Does that not testify to the sparks of holiness burning in their hearts? He says, there's holiness in everybody. And so the argument goes, yeah, they also do things I don't like. They want to pray with a Torah at the Western Wall. You know what? At least they want to pray, and at least they want to read from a Torah. They want to wear tefillin. That's great. There are an awful lot of men who don't want to wear tefillin. I'm glad that we have this about them. And so I'm not going to get hung up on the fact that what they're doing is something I don't personally approve of. It's not live and let live, which says, I can't do anything about it, so let it be. It's, I respect them for the good that they are doing, and value that for what it is, and hold off on the other aspects. Possibly. I'm not an expert on Chabad, so I would I'll leave it to Chabad to explain itself. But I hear what you're saying, and it does fit things that I've heard. That's what I would say. The third approach of the four that we'll look at is to say, let's reinterpret their intent. If you take a look at source number 11 from the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Karelitz, who we mentioned earlier, he says, you know, they don't know any better. The people you're talking about, the people who are doing these things, are not necessarily people who had the same Jewish education that I did. And had they had the benefit of my education, they probably would think as I think. But because they didn't have it, therefore they come out doing other things, thinking other things. Take a look at source number 11. He says, at a time of divine invisibility, when faith has been cut off from the poor of the nation, punishment does not mend the gap, but only increases it. For it appears like a deed of destruction and coercion, God forbid. If I'm going to start educating people, if I'm going to try to get people to do what I think is right, they're not going to see this as helping them. They're going to see this as coercing them, right? The point that was made before, trying to educate others may be something that is hateful to them. That's what he says you'll see now. Since our entire goal is to repair, the law, meaning of punishing wrongdoing, does not apply when it doesn't repair. We are obligated to bring them back with, quote, avotot ahava, a phrase from Tanakh, ropes of love, to bring them to the radiant light to the extent we can. The message is that the people you're talking about are not terrible people. They're not to be viewed as sinners. They're people who are doing what they do because they don't know better, but they aren't going to accept what I tell them either. Maybe ignorant, or if not ignorant, I would use a phrase which sounds funny, but I'm actually serious, differently educated. But not even ill-informed, but differently informed. In other words, these are people who look around at the world with a set of values that this world, I think, by and large, certainly the Western world has, and that lead them to certain conclusions. I have a different set of values that lead me to a different set of conclusions. You know, for people who value religious freedom above all, for them, what they're doing is entirely logical. For someone who is educated in a system that says the Torah set out rules, and these are your rules, and this is what you're supposed to follow, the idea of religious freedom is not in concert. It doesn't fit. They're in a different value system, and therefore they'll be viewed as either mistaken, or there are other legal categories that can be invoked. But the point is, you know, they're not going to listen, which is sort of shades of approach number one. They're not going to listen to us anyway. But more than that, it will be destructive for me to try to do anything with it. Because whereas what they're doing is fundamentally, you know, ill-informed, misinformed, however you want to look at it, at least right now, yeah, they're doing what they're doing. I'm not antagonizing them. In the event that I try to get them to do something positive that I think is positive, it's only going to antagonize them. Better just to leave it. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a little problem with that because you're basically saying because you don't have the same education as me, you're not the same person. You're different, right? And you know you're creating separation between people. You're saying they act that way because they're not as well educated. They're mentally deficient.
I don't think anyone says mentally deficient.
No, I'm not saying that, but the exception goes.
I don't think. Is it a matter of creating division, or is it just recognizing division that's there anyway?
Well, I think by saying that they're less than I am is is a way of creating division.
I think the less than is a charged term, and I'm not sure that it really applies to the argument he's making. I agree with you that he is saying if they had been raised the way I was,
they would think what I think.
They would think what I think. And if I had been raised as they were, then I would think what they think. It's true, he doesn't use the reverse law. Right. I mean, there's self-righteousness from both perspectives. Self-righteousness is not the exclusive domain of one side. Well, it's not even as much of a let them be. I think it's stronger. I think the first view that we had said was more or less, if they're not hurting anybody, let them be. I think his approach that he's promoting here is to say, it's not their fault that they're doing that which they are doing. And therefore, it doesn't really need correction, and any attempt to correct it would actually make things worse.
In this instance, either party could be saying those exact words about the other.
Yes.
If only they said we drink the back and ropes of blood to bring education
yeah.
Light, and the goal is to be fair and not punished.
Right, that would be nice. That would be very nice. The problem... Yeah?
Because I'm not sure that would be nice. Because it's still from the perspective of the person who thinks that he or she has more knowledge or more education than the other person. The other person could be quite happy in their perspective, could also be a sort of, yes, you have different beliefs than I do, we are raised differently, we have different values, whatever. And that person might say, well, the ropes of love will bring you closer to my side. But
right.
We don't usually hear that side. So I'm saying, just assuming that either person is values are better than somebody else's, I think is condescending.
Right. Unfortunately, it's reality.
But two
things. One is that I think all Shirley meant, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, was just that it's nice to hear oratory of love and light, as opposed to those people are terrible and we need to change them. But I think you do get it both ways. For example, the issue of certain groups within the Haredi community in Israel not wanting to send their kids to college, and then not wanting them to go out and get jobs and wanting the sons to go out to go to yeshiva rather than, and the argument that's made of, well, they're perpetuating a cycle of poverty, we need to enlighten them about vocational schools. We need to enlighten them about the importance in Jewish tradition of earning a living. Now, I happen to be of the belief that one should go out and earn a living. My kids, God willing, are all going to go to university when they are of age. But I find it just as condescending when there are initiatives made to enlighten the Haredi community about the joys of going to work. Now, the truth is that it's a bad example in the sense that if they don't go to work, they often end up being a burden to society as a whole, and then others are going to end up needing to support them. So I understand that it's an imperfect example. But the reality is that the sense of my values are better is common to both sides. But what I want to focus on for the next couple of minutes is the fourth approach. So I think it's a valuable approach. And this is something which is raised as a point by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in source number 12. This is a response from Rabbi Auerbach. Rabbi Auerbach was a leading rabbi in Israel. He passed away, it's got to be about 10 to 15 years ago at this point. Longer ago? How long ago? Was it that long? No. That's unbelievable. It can't be that long ago. Anyway, I met him. Rabbi Auerbach, rabbi in Yerushalayim, was known, among other things, for his moderate approach and for his embrace of others and respect for others. 95. See, I told you it wasn't that long ago. So Rabbi Auerbach is dealing with a very interesting question. Jewish law says that I'm not allowed to cause somebody to stumble. The Torah says, "Lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol." Do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Included within that is that I'm not allowed to set somebody up to transgress Jewish law. Not only am I not allowed to cause them to stumble physically, but I'm not allowed to cause them to stumble spiritually. And so the question arises, within Jewish law, before we eat food, we recite a blessing. Am I allowed to give food to somebody if I know that they're not going to recite a blessing? Now, you never know, for sure, but I know, because I've seen this person eat before. They're not reciting blessings. They may never even have learned the blessings to recite, and they would not take kindly to being told, make a blessing, or I'm going to say a blessing for you, and you answer, it's not going to go. So the question he asks is, so are you allowed? Or are you in the very awkward position of inviting people to your home and not giving them food? Because you don't want to cause them to stumble. And Rabbi, this is a hot debate. There are various sages weigh in on different sides of it. But Rabbi Auerbach says something very interesting in source number 12. He says, if you don't give him food, I'll say it outside before reading it inside the text. He says, if you don't give him food, right? You invite him to your house, and you say, I'm not giving him food. Or worse, there are people around who do say blessings, and they have the food, and you don't offer him food. What's the end result going to be? What's it going to cause?
Strife,
hatred, animosity. You know, what is this? I need to do that. I don't want anything to do with him at all. And Rabbi Auerbach says, you will end up in violation of a verse that we mentioned before, or causing him to violate a verse that we mentioned before, I should say. Lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha. He is going to hate you for it. So by, yes, it's true, if you give him food, then you cause him to not say a blessing. There's a rabbinic commandment to say a blessing. But if you don't give him food, you cause him to violate a biblical law, because he's going to hate you. So which way are you better off? So therefore he says, now take a look at number 12. He says, this is like one who cuts off a person's toe in order to save him from needing to cut off his entire hand. The toe and the hand. That's a very hot. I just noticed that. That's pretty funny. Obviously, this is not some kind of gangrene case, I guess. But obviously, he says, this is not called harm, but repair. He is performing a mitzvah, not a transgression. In other words, if you amputate for somebody medically, what you're doing is a good thing. You're not considered harming the person. So too here, he says, he's not causing this person to stumble when he gives him the food. Just the opposite. With this deed, he's saving this person from the grave sin of hating Torah and its students. Still, the matter requires resolution. Rabbi Auerbach says, I have to admit, what I'm proposing here is difficult. But what he's proposing is, perform the lesser sin. The lesser sin is giving him food. The greater sin is withholding it. Recognize the value of joining together with others and decreasing animosity. Rabbi Cook made a similar point in source number 13 in Orot HaTchiyah. He says, there is no end to the material and spiritual ills involved in splitting the nation into segments, even though a full separation as imagined by those who would cut cruelly cannot and will not be. Such is an idolatrous plan. He says it's idolatrous to try to split the Jewish people into different segments. We value our existence as a single nation. And on that basis, the argument is, having a single united nation of Jews in Israel is a greater goal than winning the individual battle over how prayer is going to go at the Western Wall, or fill in the blank on some of the other cases we discussed, the buses on Shabbos, the chametz sold in the store on Passover, and so on. Now, how you make this calculation is very tricky, and I don't think this is simple and straightforward, that, you know, with one fell swoop you can say, well, it's all in the name of unity, and therefore it's all okay. That's a little bit too easy. But I think that fundamentally, the principle that he's offering is a valuable one. And I think it's more positive and more constructive than some of the other approaches. As opposed to an approach that says, well, I can't do anything about them anyway, so, you know, deal with it, our first approach. Or as opposed to an approach that says, you know what, see them as positive because they're building up the land, and then on that basis ignore the bad that's going on. Or the approach of, you know what, it's not really their fault that they're doing what they're doing. This approach says that it's a positive, it's what we call in Hebrew, lechatchila. This is what we want. This is actually our primary goal, is to create a nation for everybody, and on that basis, override and not solve some of the practical problems which may arise on some of the individual issues. And so that's a fourth potential argument in favor of religious freedom in a Jewish state. Comments? We all commented out. Yeah?
I think a lot of it has to do basically with respect and not shaming someone else. And by performing some mitzvah or whatever, if somebody can observe another doing it and without feeling shame because they are not doing it, it's more of a pull than a push.
Right. And I think you're right. I think the non-judgmental type of an approach in which, you know, I'm going to do what I do and hope that they see what I'm doing is described well as Kiddush Hashem. Right? The Talmud in the volume called Yuma says, Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, right? You shall love Hashem, your God, means that not only you should love God, but that you should act in a way that people who see you will also come to love God. And it gives examples. It talks about a person speaking gently to others. It talks about dealing with others with respect. And as a representative of Torah who conducts himself in a way that people will respect, you will cause others to develop a love of God. And the opposite is Chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name, which one is supposed to avoid. So I agree with you that that's a way to deal with things. I think it runs into technical challenges when you're dealing with a country as a whole. But I think fundamentally it's a very important approach. Yes?
The point that you made, and yeah, I must bring up the revenant. They have been saying things and doing things that contradict what you have just suggested, namely that they have been discriminating, they have been insulting, they have been doing and saying all kinds of things that does not warm one to their kind of Judaism. And that's the problem in Israel right now. There's been articles written by prominent Jews from around the world that they should actually be privatized and there should not be a chief rabbinate, and that all different segments of Judaism can all have their own chiefdoms, if I can say, and they would all then practice freely as they wish. And many Jews would then be drawn to the ultra-Orthodox who want their pure example to demonstrate that theirs is the way to go. But right now I think it is actually distancing Jews.
So the chief rabbinate is a problem within a problem within a problem. In the sense that, I'm not going to deal with any particular, you know, and specific chief rabbis or their individual actions, but in the sense that they're put in the position of being gatekeepers. And a gatekeeper is never going to be popular. If they are responsible to safeguard marriage that certain rules are followed, for example, or conversions that certain rules are followed, inevitably there are going to be people who don't like them. That's one problem. Second problem, they function in a world that is their world without necessarily being aware of and open to and sensitive to some of the things that are outside of that world, and that creates communication problems. You know, echo chambers in politics are seen all the time, and people convince themselves because they talk to like-minded people, and then they say things that the rest of the world looks at and says, "What are you thinking?" An echo chamber is a second dimension of problem. But the fundamental issue is, can you survive as a nation without having a gatekeeper on certain matters?
I have something to say on that.
That's from them.
What you have just said to me is how the Japanese have been cheating Jews in the diaspora, telling them they are not Jews.
I'm pretty sure they didn't say that.
Many, many very revered Orthodox rabbonim who have done conversions and then found that the rabbi has rejected these conversions. And
I fear for the
continued existence of Israel because of all this, because I think that their actions and their opinions have been distancing many Jews in the diaspora, and particularly in the U.S., from Israel, saying if I'm not recognized as Jewish, Israel to me, and that will impact on the lobbying of the U.S. government, that Israel really badly, very badly needs in this hostile world.
So I'm really going to leave this one. I mean, conversion is a complicated topic. It's not simple and straightforward. I know the rabbis who you are talking about whose conversions have been rejected, and I know some of the issues that are involved, and let me tell you, it is offensive, number one, but number two, it is complicated. It is not straightforward. And it's not something I'm going to do justice to, at this point. The point that I do want to make, though, because I think it does relate back to our topic as a whole, and so I thank you for raising it, is the problem of religious freedom across the board. Are there any red zones? Are there areas where you say, you know what, in this area, having religious freedom runs counter to the interests of the nation, in the same way that the Muslim family in Switzerland was told, in Switzerland we generally believe in freedom, and we generally would say you could raise your children however you like, but we believe that boys and girls have to swim together in our country. Why? I don't know, I'm not Swiss. But that's what they said. There may be red zones. There may be certain areas within Israel where you have to say, on this, we need to not have religious freedom. I'll give you an example, and then I'm going to actually say that's it for the public questions, and people can stick around afterwards and continue to discuss if you want. But I'll give you an example that comes to mind. The Shemitah cycle. Every 7 years in Israel, right, we are taught that the land is supposed to lay fallow. Right? Today it's a rabbinic law rather than a biblical law, but the law still remains. There is a solution which much of the country relies on, called the Heter Mechira, right? Which we're not going to go into in great detail, but bottom line is, it relies on the idea that the farmers are selling their land to non-Jews, it will be worked by non-Jews, and that's okay, you can then use the produce from that land during the sabbatical year. Again, how it works is a technical discussion, we could have some other time. There are observant Jews in Israel who don't accept the Heter Mechira. They don't like it. And in the last Shemitah cycle, the army ran into a very interesting problem. You see, the army's been recruiting heavily to get the Haredim into the army. But now, they have a problem come Shemitah, because the Haredim don't eat the Heter Mechira. They don't rely on that. And so the army found itself needing to order produce from abroad in order to satisfy those soldiers. Now you'll say, well, what about if an Israeli says, I'm not interested in eating Jordanian produce. I want Israeli produce, and I have the right for my religious freedom. The army's going to say, well, we're not sitting here and ordering, this isn't El Al, where you're going to get this kind of kosher meal, and you're going to get this kind of kosher meal. It's not going to work that way. And so, since it is in the national interest to make sure the Haredim are going to come serve, we're going to order food that satisfies everybody. That happens sometimes in a country. The country says, you know what, we need to establish certain red lines and certain zones, and say, this is going to be a different field. And it could be that that happens with conversion. It could be it happens with marriage and divorce. I don't have the answer. But I'm saying that in certain areas, you may well need to say, there has to be an authority. They should be polite. They should be transparent. they should not be out to offend everybody who disagrees with them. But you may need gatekeepers on certain issues in order to gain unity of society. And I think that realistically, every civilized country on earth, Canada very much included, has red zones like that, certain areas in which you don't have the freedom to do as you choose. I could give you examples of it. I'm going to stop the class at large so that people can leave if they wish.